If you remember, the question I'm trying to answer in these Wangaway lectures is the origins and nature, possibly some hints of the future of the modern world. And I defined in the first lecture, I defined modernity as the artificial separation out of the four main strands of our lives: politics or power, economy, society, religion and thought, and the separation between them, which I think is the essence, quintessence of modernity. And I likened what has happened to creating a very long and complicated key where you have to get the right combination, or like creating a jigsaw puzzle and getting all the parts to fit together. Modernity is not one thing. You may have thought at the beginning of these lectures that modernity was to do with mobile phones or bullet trains or high technology or something like that, something technological, scientific, modern sounding. But I've tried to explain that modernity, that is the effect, maybe. But modernity is much deeper than that and consists of many parts, which if you don't get the right combination, any single part will not work. And that is particularly true of what I'll be talking about today, which is political power and various forms, including democracy. So the first lecture looked at the question. The question is, how did modernity occur? And then I looked at war, trade and empire. The fact that England, which I take to be the first modern society, had a very warlike external, but inside it was very peaceful. It's a great trading empire, which at one point held a quarter of the world and therefore projected out its kind of modernity. It was the first to have an agricultural revolution in the long period up to the 18th century, and the first industrial revolution of the middle of the 18th century. It was the first capitalist society. I argue from the Middle Ages onwards, in terms of its use of money and its attitudes. First to have really wealthy standard of living for at least half of the population, comfortable houses, clothes, food, and so on. One of the great founders of the scientific revolution, and having the two oldest continuous universities in the world, Oxford and Cambridge. It had a modern kind of class system, not based on birth, but based on achievement and money. And it developed a culture around sport, play, games, which has been exported to much of the world. In the last lecture, we looked at the very strange family system, which exported the children away from home, and they were brought up in schools or as apprentices and elsewhere, which led to the need for friends and the development of friendship as a big institution in England. And also, I ended with the idea that England developed early on what we now call civil society. That is, a large number of organizations which are not to do with the state, which lie between the state and the individual. Games organizations, intellectual organizations, religious organizations. The next two bits of the puzzle, the jigsaw puzzle, are, again, each one is really terribly important. Each one I come to, I'll say, well, this is the most important, because in a way, each of them is important. This is terribly important, the class system. Civil society is terribly important. But so also are power and law. To get the right political system, you could not have had a modern world, in our sense, without getting the right combination in terms of power and politics. You can now just buy many things of modernity, its technologies, sciences, and so on and so on, as it were, out of a shop, out of American shops. Not literally, but you can learn about them, and then you can transport them to many parts of the world. You don't have to be politically modern to do that. But at the beginning, to have the first modernity, you had to have the right political structure. And we think now that it has happened, that maybe it's quite easy to get the right balance of power, as we say. In fact, it's incredibly difficult for one very simple reason, which was put forward in a quotation which I had mentioned in an earlier lecture by the Cambridge historian Lord Acton in his famous remark that all power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. He, in his great studies of liberty, had come to the conclusion, looking at all of history, this is what happens. As people become more powerful, particularly politicians and those who rule, they tend to become corrupted. That is, they want more power. And if they have more power, they want more power and more power until they become absolute rulers, and then they are absolutely corrupted. This is a very strong tendency, which you can see in the history of all empires and all nations, more or less, except in England. It's the one country over a long period, of course, there have been smaller countries, there have been places like Florence or Holland or small places which have been quite democratic and power has not entirely corrupted. Greece at a certain period, Rome at the beginning. But gradually they've either been destroyed by their neighbours or become corrupted and lost that. So, just as games and sports came from England and many of the other things I've talked about, modern political forms, which dominate much of the world, though not all of it, came from England. And this came out of a particular balance between the state and the individual, which is very unusual and very difficult to maintain over a long period. We sometimes call this democracy, but most people think, in the West anyway, if you just ask people what democracy is, well, rule of the people, for the people, by the people, or whatever, and probably they start thinking of parliaments and people voting in voting boxes. So when, for example, various Western leaders decided that they wanted Iraq or Afghanistan to be democratic, they thought, well, if you set up a parliament, you allow the people to vote, you've got democracy. That's not exactly how I'll be using the word democracy. Voting is a little bit of it, but it is the end product, and it is only a little bit of it. It means something much more, much wider, much deeper in political philosophy. In general, it means a freedom to discuss, to talk about what you want to talk about, to act and to participate in running your own life, to form into organizations, and generally to take control of your life, of which only a part is voting for someone who then acts as your representative. This idea of freedom of association, freedom of discussion, and freedom to choose the people who rule you is, in England, a very old concept. In an encyclopedia of the 13th century, it states, an English encyclopedia says, men are oftentimes able to give, to play and to be happy, free men of heart and with tongue. So they have free hearts and they have free tongues. They can speak about what they wish. It wasn't an easy thing to invent, and I'll talk more about that. And it wasn't an easy thing to spread. We think, well, once you've got this very good idea of democracy, perhaps ruling yourselves and having freedom, the idea will spread very quickly. And you may think that England maybe invented it first in some early period, but very quickly it spread across Western Europe, but it didn't. Even by the later 19th century, after it had been going in England for 400 or 500 years, a Frenchman, Hippolyte Taine, said, British citizens enjoy full freedom of speech and association. And they have a special constitutional system, which they call constitutional monarchy. But when they tried to export this to Europe, it failed almost entirely. It was successful, he said, only in Holland, Belgium, and Scandinavian countries by that time. It really hadn't taken off in the rest of Europe. And even if you go nearly a century after Taine, if you go to 1945, if you looked around Europe, that's only 60 years ago, you'd have seen a Europe that was completely unfree and undemocratic. Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, France, Germany, all of them were fascist countries. So democracy is very, very new in Europe. It was attempted a little bit before and then swept away. But in England, it's been a gradual growth, like a tree growing for some 600, 700, 800 years. And this is why it's so difficult to take somewhere else, because you can't take a tree and just put it somewhere else. You need to let it grow up. And Taine himself said this. He said, we admire the stability of British government, but this stability is the final product, the fine flower at the extremity of an infinite number of living fibers, that's the roots, firmly planted in the soil of the entire country. Democracy, this freedom, and this way of government is the final flower coming out of all these thousands of roots. This is why Western attempts recently to just plonk what they think is democracy in Middle Eastern and other countries has been a complete failure. It has to be, it's like putting a carpet without putting the carpet underneath. You have to have many of these things, and you particularly have to have some civil society, particular class system, and so on. It needs training, it needs experience, it has to evolve gradually, and it has to be wanted by the people. It did happen first in England. You'll have to largely accept my word for that, but it's usually acknowledged that democracy in the modern form was developed in England. For instance, Karl Jaspers, a great German sociologist and philosopher, said that the concept of political freedom comes from England. He says, in the West, certain fundamental determinants of the idea of political freedom have been evolved, originally, above all, in England and America, from whence they were taken over by France and other states. He says, the greatest, most effectual, and most powerful exception of all to absolutism is England together with America. This was the birthplace of the influence that set free the states of the continent, but only in part. He dates the liberty of England, its basic freedoms, from the 12th century, that is 900 years ago. I would think it might be older than that. He says the classical development of political freedom, which gives at least an orientation to all, that's the world, and is for many exemplary, the big example, occurred more than 700 years ago in England. On this spiritual political fundamental, liberty was created afresh in America. it's taken from England to America, out with the British imperial system, and has spread over much of the planet. Why it's difficult to do is that you have to have a particular balance between two strong tendencies. One is to centralize power, and one is to fragment or decentralize power. And it is this issue which de Tocqueville examines. If you, I'll quote him, as he said, there are two great drawbacks to avoid in organizing a country. Either the whole strength of social organization is centered on one point, everything comes out from that point, or it is spread over the country. Either alternative has its advantages and its drawbacks. If all the power is tied into one bundle at the center, fascism means bundling, comes from the Italian word to bundle together. If everything is drawn together into one bundle, and the bundle gets undone, a bundle is, say, sticks, which you tie up with a piece of string. The bundle gets undone, the sticks fall in all directions. Everything falls apart, and there is no nation left. Where power is dispersed, where it's everywhere, it takes much longer to do things, because you can't just decide to build a high-speed railway or an airport or do something. You have to get lots of people's permission. So he saw these as the two contrasted tendencies. He realized that in order to have a modern and effective state, you have to have quite a lot of centralization. He says, in England, the centralization of the government is carried to great perfection. England is a very centralized country in many ways. Everything comes down from the center and goes up to the center. There is no alternative source of power than the center. He says, the state has the compact vigor of one man. It's as if it's just one person. And it will put immense masses in motion and turn its whole power where it pleases. This is why it was a great imperial nation and a great war nation. But England, which has done so great things for the last 50 years, this is Tocqueville, has never centralized its administration. And this is very, very important. It's politically centralized, but bureaucratically decentralized. Bureaucracy means administration, it's office work, it's carrying out the work of the government. On the other hand, the legal system, which I'll talk more about, has to be centralized. You can't have lots of different legal systems operating. The English are the first people who ever thought of centralizing the administration of justice. This is Tocqueville. This innovation, this new idea, which dates from the Norman period, that's nearly 1,000 years ago, should be reckoned one of the reasons for the quicker progress which this nation has made in civilization and liberty. On the other hand, administration, carrying out the wishes of the government, is very localized, is down away from the center. He says, England is the country of decentralization. You have a government, but you don't have a central administration. Each county, that's the region, you have counties in China, each county, each town, each parish looks after its own interests. So you don't have a huge central bureaucracy. There were very few civil servants, those are the people who work in the bureaucracy in England until quite recently, till the 20th century. It was unlike Spain or Italy or France, where there were huge numbers of officials. There were hardly any officials in England, because nearly all the administration of politics was done by volunteers, by amateurs, by local people who, as part of their daily life, would do the administration. I found this to be the same sort of thing that happened when I went to the University of Cambridge. Well, the University of Cambridge until recently, because it's become much more bureaucratic recently, but until recently there was hardly any bureaucracy at all. There was the Chancellor, the Vice-Chancellor, a few officials, less than the number in this room, perhaps. And then everything else was done by the teaching staff. We ran our lives, we ran our meetings, we organised our finances, everything was done by us. And there was very little bureaucracy above us. And that was the model for the whole country. This led to a great pleasure in ruling yourself. The English like to rule themselves. Tocqueville says, finally, the Englishman's great objection to allowing the government to do his business, even well, is simply his wish to do it himself. This passion for being a master at home, even to act foolishly, essentially characterizes the British race. He says a person would rather do something badly themselves than have the government do it, saying they would do it better. We'd like to run our own life. Tocqueville saw this as a unique political system, which had emerged on this island and spread to America. And the electing of people to a parliament, the House of Commons or whatever, was just a tiny part of this. That was just the tip of the top. Below was a huge system of local administration which people were involved with. This system of local administration, which made each small parish, that is a little village in the surrounding area, almost a country in itself, is what we mean by self-government. One of the commentators on Tocqueville says, the ensemble, that's the joining together of English institutions, is doubtless an aristocratic government. And this is one of the special things about English democracy until very recently. It was an aristocratic, that is, it was the upper middle class, the gentlemen who I mentioned to you before, who tended to run much of the administration and who tended to be the people who went to the House of Commons and so on. So the upper middle class, it was an aristocratic form of democracy. But it was acceptable because they ran it, much of the centralized or the central part, and at the local level they were at the higher level. But below them were many people who took part in government. So this commentator continues, but there is not a parish in England which does not constitute a free republic. Now you may have been taught in, it would be interesting to ask you, but you may have been taught, if you were taught any history of the West, that the English political revolution leading to modern democracy was the product either of what is called the Glorious Revolution, 1688, when James II was thrown out and William of Orange came to England. That is the Glorious Revolution, which led to a new constitution. Or you may have been taught that it was a result of the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell. Or you may have actually not heard about those at all and been told that modern democracy came from the French Revolution or the American War of Independence. All of those are parts of the process, but they are not the core of it, because they are very late. Already, long before the 17th century, you have a place where you have a great deal of freedom of association, liberty, and above all, a contractual and balanced power between the rulers, the king, the crown, and ordinary people. The heart of the English system was the idea of a political contract. A contract is something which you enter into, you have to enter into freely. You agree that I will do this if you will do that. That is a contract. And it is totally different from most political situations where you are born with someone who is perhaps thought to be a ruler who has been given their power and control from heaven, as in the divine right of kings in France and so on. In England, there was the idea that the rulers and the people had a contract with each other. You find it formally stated in John Locke, but it is an ancient tradition in England. It was reaffirmed in 1215, which is an awful long time ago, in the famous contract written down called the Great Contract, or Charter, Magna Carta. So, at least from that time, and before, this was just a reaffirmation, some 800 years ago, the English had set up, they said, if the king does this, we will do that, but if he breaks his contract, or we break our contract, then the contract is ended. Some 200 years after this, just over 200 years after this, England was torn by some wars, and during these wars, the young king, as he was to be, Henry VI, was exiled to France, sent to France, with his chief justice, his chief legal officer, Sir John Fortescue, who thought he should teach the king how he would rule if he came back into power, how the English political system worked. Basic text in English politics. So he wrote a book which is very important, and it describes that England is a limited monarchy. It's not like France, this man, Sir John Fortescue, said. In France, the king is supreme. In England, the king is under the law and in a contractual relationship with ordinary people. England is an association of free people held together by mutual contracts. Because, as Fortescue says, people are not going to join together into a country except voluntarily giving their allegiance to someone. Why should they follow someone without having some contractual relationship? So this is the essence of a certain kind of balance which lies behind democracy. It's what Montesquieu found in England, what was taken to America, but it goes back into a very ancient tradition. But it's so unusual that you have to ask, why did it occur and why did it continue? The answer, the simple answer, is that England was an island. Because it was quite a big island, it meant that it didn't have to have an army, a big army, to protect it against the neighboring countries. The Scots were up there, but they were not a huge threat most of the time. So England never had a very large, or it didn't have what's called a standing army, that is a set of people who were constantly there with weapons. So the king had no permanent troops. And this had all sorts of effects. It meant, for instance, when during the civil wars, Charles I was fighting against Cromwell, he didn't have an army. He had to recruit and make an army. So the king lacked power to push down the population. Also, it meant that you didn't have to have such a high tax rate to support the army. You had a big navy, but the navy cannot come on land and support the king. So the fact of not being a landed continental power was really the key. Another key was this class system, because you had a very large middle class, as I tried to explain, and these were a defense against too much power concentrating up at the top. You might have quite a powerful king, but he had to get the agreement of this huge middle class. He couldn't rule without them. As I've explained, they were the local rulers. They weren't paid by him. He couldn't sack them. They didn't want to do what he wanted them to do. There was nothing much he could do about it. He needed the consent, and these are the educated, rich, powerful people who go to the House of Commons and the House of Lords and who stand up against the king if he becomes too powerful. So the large educated middle class, which was unique to England, was behind democracy. Finally, just to put this into a context which I'll develop in my last lecture. Democracy comes, the powerful want to become more powerful. What is going to stop them? In the 12th century, that is 800 years ago, Europe had four great powers. It had the king. Each of the different countries in Europe had kings. They had nobles and the aristocracy, rich, powerful people. They had the church and the clergymen. And they had the towns, merchants. This was universal across Europe about 800 years ago. What gradually happened over all continental Europe, in the wars and divisions and the need to be protected by the king and his army, the king gradually got more and more powerful until by the 18th century you have what are known as absolute monarchies in Germany, France, and elsewhere. The king dominated the church, but ruled with the church. So this group, Roman Catholics and Catholic kings, aided by Roman law, which is very late Roman law, which is very absolutist, grew very powerful, and these people became very weak. The nobles came to the court and became subservient. The towns were crushed and very weak. So gradually, all power concentrated. And that was what happened in France and Italy and so on. In England, for a number of reasons, including Irelandhood, all these things remained quite powerful. The church always remained quite powerful. The aristocracy were always powerful. The towns and merchants and ordinary people. And the king. So none of these dominated. They were always in tension with each other. And if you looked at the history of China, for instance, you'd find the same, and you applied this kind of scheme to it. China has never really, until after the destruction of the Buddhists, never really had that. The towns and merchants were weak and crushed. There isn't a nobility and aristocracy. So China really was left with imperial power, just one part of it. This is the solution that ended up in, much of it ended up with, but it is a trend which has been a long one in China and as well. So democracy, to end, when I was writing a letter to granddaughter, I asked her to read the title, and she read all the titles. She was only about 8 at the time, and she came to this one and she said, "What is the reason for demo crazy?" I thought demo crazy is a very good expression for democracy. As Winston Churchill, I think, who was one of our great leaders, put it, democracy is the worst of all political systems, except for all the others, which are even worse. It has many faults. It's difficult to maintain. But we in the West believe that it, among all the systems, it gives more satisfaction than others. Thank you very much.